Greetings, podcast listeners. This is one of your co-hosts, Trevor, here to tell you that I'm coming to you. This is a Nighthawks anomaly. It is actually the middle of the day. It is actually mid-afternoon, beautiful sunshiny day, partly cloudy skies. But we're here at the Nighthawks Overlook Studios, and it's a bustling day. We've got a food truck down there, some traffic, some people doing some weekend shopping in the downtown area. So if you hear any of that, that's what's going on. But I'm really here to tell you that, and this will come as no surprise to fans of the podcast, but I'm here to tell you that the time between when we record and when we release, there's sometimes a huge span of time in there, and it's just, we like to produce, we like to get a little creative, we like to, you know, we like to rub our own brand of stank on it, and, you know, we like to take our time with our episodes, and we feel that's kind of part of what we bring to the table here at the Nighthawks Cafe. What we wanted to be kind of an aperitif, we recognize that there's a lot going on in the world, and maybe we wanted to talk about something a little nostalgic and a little fun, and maybe a little bit zany! But sometimes, because of that lapse, things can happen in the real world that will affect the timing of an episode. And in this case, we woke up this morning specifically to edit this episode and woke to the news about 6 hours ago that the acclaimed animator Richard Williams, who had an instrumental hand in the animation of Roger Rabbit and the world of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it was announced he passed away this morning. So now it has this kind of weird pallor of a tragic passing hanging over it. And that's something that, you know, unfortunately, we here in the Nighthawks studio and the people at the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network and a lot of our friends and colleagues who work and live in the entertainment and podcast industries, it seems like this has just been a hard year or so in the world of loss. You know, I'm not sure that any of us knew Richard Williams personally, but we have lost a few people in our community. And it's, you know, you do what you can with it. It sucks. But as kind of what the influencers of today would call a call to action, we decided that because our fun episode now kind of has this drag beginning to it, we'd like to turn that around and say, listen, if you're a pal of the podcast, if you're a friend of the network, if you're just out to be a good human being, looking to make the day a little bit better for yourself and those around you, do just that. Find a worthy cause, find a charity, find an organization or a nonprofit that you believe in, and make a money or time donation to some of these folks and some of these organizations, and just work to make the world just a little bit better. And if we all do that together, maybe we can have, if nothing else, a really solid day, which would just be nice. Let's work to make the world a little bit better, a little bit nicer, after we've lost some really wonderful, nice people, including Richard Williams, one of the lead animators on Roger Rabbit. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the Nighthawks podcast covers Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
We are rolling. Hey, we don't have to slate this time.
We're slateless in Seattle.
Oh, I need to get...
Should we make deep-voiced ASMR channels?
Yes.
Yes, always.
I am opening a package of Planters peanuts. We're in the same room, Matt. Furry little Tony.
We're looking at kitties.
We're looking at cat pics. Hashtag cats of Instagram. Hashtag cats of Nighthawks.
Yeah, we are, as they say in chemistry, covalent.
How you doing, Matt? Good to see you live and in person in the conceptual Nighthawks diner.
I am okay. I'm a little sunburned, a little recreation with the folks. I'm crispy as a lobster on one side.
Yeah, you kind of look like Richard Dreyfuss on Close Encounters.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away. He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get to Texas.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Nighthawks podcast, the cinema-centric podcast for those of you who like to stay up after hours. And we are a couple of those folks. We're staying up after hours with you. But, you know, it's a podcast. Listen when you want. And when you do, you can find us on Apple Podcasts. You can find us on Spotify. You can find us on Google Podcasts. You can find us on Stitcher. You can find us on Last.fm. You know, we're just all over the place. But if you want to reach out, we're probably most active on Yay Old Facebook. You can find us at Nighthawks Podcast. And the Nighthawks Podcast is celebrating 1 year partnership with the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network, home of such other fantastic podcasts as Geek Parenting and the Funny Books and Firewater Podcasts. Be sure to check those out. So, Matt, how are you? How was the drive?
Pretty long and strange. Like it's the drive from Salt Lake to Casper will make you think that you're like in an episode of Supernatural. You're gonna have to, there's a lot of ghost towns. There's Rollins, which should
basically
be
a ghost town. Yeah, so, it has the famous old penitentiary, Frontier Penitentiary there. Not that I bring up because I think we have a lot of travelers on the podcast, but it was the filming location for one prison by Rennie Harlan, featuring a early star turn by Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah, and they kind of ruin it for the rest of us.
You know, it's funny. I toured the old. You can take tours of the old penitentiary, and if you're ever in the Rollins area, I would suggest doing that and then leaving immediately.
Actually, I will plug the Thai restaurant in Rollins.
Yeah, Anong's Thai Anong restaurant. Thai, yeah.
Inexplicably has the best ribeye for 500 miles or so.
But Rollins, I mean, there's just not much going on there. It's kind of a little stop on the highway, and that's about all it's ever really become. I mean, they are a proud people, and they have their own city and life and culture and school and sports, but... As far as the tourists go, I'd say the prison is probably the highlight of that particular destination. And when I saw it when I was a kid, there was a lot of hemming and hawing about the movie because the production team had gone in and changed a lot of features of this former actual penitentiary just to look better for Hollywood. And by the time production wrapped, they had run out of money and didn't fix any of it. So that was a bone of contention for a while. But recently, as I have talked with folks from there 25 years on, they're not nearly as upset about it. They're kind of over it. They realize that it's its own part of the history and the just the character of the place.
Enter another world.
We're just hanging around this slaughterhouse waiting for Carter.
Sir, the power's down all over the prison.
Where something is trapped in the dark.
Something grab hold of me.
Some things just won't stay buried.
It's something evil.
I summon the creature of darkness.
It's something inhuman.
What's happening in there?
And it's waiting for someone.
Come forth and show yourself!
To open the door.
I have to say, like, the whole drive, if you're into, like, you know, if old shacks covered in graffiti are your thing, But there's some interesting stuff.
I will say, you know, that stretch, you have to be on I-80 for a good portion of that through the Great Basin in Wyoming. And boy, is there a better place, or there is no better place, I think, to fire up about 30 episodes of Welcome to Night Vale, driving through that in the middle of the night.
Oh, have you ever listened to Alice Isn't Dead?
I haven't.
Alice Isn't Dead is a Night Vale spinoff. This is incorrect to call it a spinoff. It's by the same people.
Uh-huh.
And it is about a trucker driving through like the Southwest looking for her wife.
Oh, wow.
And it's so it's just like this whole, that's the bare bones setup.
Uh-huh.
And then like, you find out over time that like she had reasons for disappearing and it's a real kind of, it gets into kind of X-Files-y territory. Conspiracy, not Freak of the Week.
Uh-huh.
But it was, I think it's in hiatus between season 2 and season 3.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty interesting.
Have you, what have you seen lately? Have you been to the movies?
Yeah, I went to Midsommar.
How was that?
It's a strange duck. I think your tolerance for Hereditary is a good barometer.
Uh-huh.
If you like one, you'll probably like the other. Had some stuff in it that I thought was pretty interesting because Hereditary is kind of based on what you might call like the John Dee era demonology.
Mm-hmm.
And Midsommar is based on kind of Swedish tradition or Scandinavian, I guess.
Yeah.
And it has some stuff in it. Like it just, and it's kind of like, it has some points to make about like cultural relativism. It all happens in bright daylight because it's the part of the year when it doesn't get dark.
It's Midsommar.
Yeah. And so like the sustained wakefulness is part of the torture, you know, it's part of what's going on. And, it's very, very psychedelic.
I see.
And very strange because everybody, the what you might call the victims in the movie spend about half of it dosed.
Uh-huh.
And it's very wild and weird and had some moments that elicited shock and nervous laughter and, again, about on par with Hereditary.
The term I keep hearing get thrown around is folk horror. Do you think that's a fair...
Kind of. It's I would say there's an element of exploitation dressed up as academia.
Uh-huh.
So there's definitely like, they're there to observe the Midsommar ritual at this place, and it's ultimately quite culturally challenging, and they don't react well.
Mm-hmm.
So it has sort of that element that we've seen before in other exploitation movies. Except it is.
Do I dare say Eli Roth? I mean, is that?
I mean, they're both of those. Like, you shouldn't compare anything this guy directs to anything Eli Roth directs. They're different, entirely different in tonality and intensity. But a little bit more like the old, you know, like it was weirdly like Cannibal Holocaust with nice white people, and that kind of made it challenging because like it's set up like any given movie where the college students are eaten by the foreigners.
Uh huh.
Except the foreigners are like super progressive Swedes. And it's not dark and it's not jungle. It's a nice forested meadow and it's bright daylight out all the time. And the sky is blue and the clouds are puffy. And it's just quite nice until something horrible happens.
I did an unseemly binge on Stranger Things. I rewatched the first two seasons and then binged season 3 when it came out. Are you caught up on that, Matt?
I didn't do a do-over, but I watched season 3.
What'd you think?
I thought it was really spooky and kind of left me with a dirty necrophiliac kind of feeling to show like a living, vibrant mall like that. And that was kind of ghoulish.
Dear God, I was wondering where you were going with that. Thank God.
No, it was a good season.
Yeah, I think I even like this a little bit more than season two. I think season two, there was some discussion on my Facebook wall as I announced that I was doing this watch through, and there was some, you know, there was some criticisms, and I think there were probably valid criticisms leveled at season two, and it was things that didn't particularly bother me. But to me, it was the iteration. It's the iteration of a property. It's, you know, Alien was the horror movie. Aliens is the action sci-fi movie. That's kind of how I felt about this. And the worm has turned yet again in Stranger Things Season 3, where instead of being the sci-fi action adventure film, we're going a little bit back to the ensemble kind of kids adventure film, but with a strong swallow of, like, Cloak and Dagger came to mind.
Well, or the kind of ensemble paranoia pieces like My Science Project or Misfits of Science.
Yeah, good call.
And they actually, I think they take a little bit of the burden of protagony off of Eleven.
Uh-huh.
And kind of split the crew into teams. And some people didn't like that. I thought it gave everybody a little more to do.
Yeah, I do too.
But...
Well, and there's so much going on with these characters, and it's so much more than who's going to end up with who and who's the romantic interest for who. And I understand there is some of that present, and, you know, some people enjoy that.
And
but
we definitely did learn that you don't mess around with Jim.
And they say you don't tug on Superman's cape. You don't spit into the wind. You don't pull a mask off an old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim. I don't.
If you're a fan of comics or even just the movies they're based on,
check out the Funny Books and Firewater podcast.
Each week, Brian,
Maya,
Todd, and Adam review a graphic novel
and discuss what drinking games should go along with it,
as well as recommend what adult beverages should be enjoyed.
A new episode drops every Monday on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher.
Funny Books and Firewater.
We're a drinking podcast with a comic book problem.
Hello, sweetie.
What would you little maniacs like to do first?
Hello, little boys, little toys.
And a bunch of a-holes.
Guess who's back? Back again. Sweetie's back. Tell a friend.
That's right. Hello, Sweetie podcast is returning with brand new episodes starting August of 2019.
That's right. You heard that correctly.
You can hear us talk about so many things like tiny hats,
thimbles,
turtles,
your mom's house,
the internet,
tiny dogs,
a game you play on your TV,
tiny dogs wearing tiny hats,
little books,
cigarettes, lots of small things.
What's with the small things?
Talking about the news in the movies,
TV,
the comic books,
music,
video games,
science, and more.
Find us everywhere you found us before. Stitcher, Apple Podcasts,
the internet,
and Google Play.
World's Backest Podcast.
I also, I have been continuing on my reading binge, even though I announced that we had, that I was trying to read more nonfiction this year, which I still am, like, about 2-to-1 nonfiction to fiction this year, but I did back-to-back read, for the first time, The Shining by Stephen King, and in preparation of the upcoming movie from Mike Flanagan, I read Dr. Sleep. Now, Matt, are either of those you familiar with?
I'm Trevor. I know how to read the talking marks. I've actually never read either of those.
You know, I get it. I get The Shining. I get
Oh, wait, you said The Shining. I have read The Shining. I thought you said The Stand.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did read The Stand last year, but The Shining, I get it. Like, I get why people don't think that the Kubrick version is a worthy adaptation. I don't know that if I necessarily agree. I don't know that they could have adapted that novel into a photorealistic play in that year with what goes on in the book.
That's what I like. The key words are based on.
Mm-hmm.
Based on a novel by Stephen King. And they hired a very strong auteur to do that adaption.
And that's the thing. It may not be the strongest adaptation of The Shining, but it is a hell of a strong film.
Well, it depends if, again, this is where like the talk of Herbert that we always bat around comes in. For the uninformed, we're constantly wrestling with how and when to do a Doom, or pardon me, not Doom, Dune.
Yeah.
Kind of series or episodes.
Yeah, that we'd probably have to split that across a few episodes. But yeah, we've been toying around with a Dune.
And the big question is like, how is it more important to be accurate to the book or more important to deliver something that a movie audience can and will watch, and that makes sense in its own medium. And there is a problem in Stephen King books where a lot of them happen in people's heads.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm excited for this Dr. Sleep thing. The person who is adapting Dr. Sleep for the screen is Mike Flanagan. Now, Dr. Sleep is the canonical book that Stephen King wrote as a follow-up to The Shining. It is the sequel to The Shining. Stephen King, however, famously was not a fan of the Stanley Kubrick adaptation of The Shining, and specifically wrote Dr. Sleep to be a sequel to the book, and is built on elements of the book that were not present in the movie. And so there's this big question over how is Mike Flanagan going to do this. Now, I believe in Mike Flanagan. Gerald's Game is another Stephen King book that happened mostly in the protagonist set. And he did a pretty deft job of bringing that to the screen. I think the forces in Dr. Sleep are a little more external. The quick log line is that Danny is now grown up, and he is still a psychic, and he is training a young psychic Padawan, and at the same time trying to protect her from a group of psychic vampires. It was a fun book. I don't know if people think it's a worthy sequel to The Shining. But
it's not the book's fault. You just made me think of the psychic vampire and What We Do in the Shadows.
All right. Well, so I'm pretty excited. Apparently, the Flanagan movie is supposed to be both an adaptation of the Stephen King book and a sequel to the Stanley Kubrick movie, and has had the blessing of both King and the Kubrick estate. So I'm excited, if nothing else, just to see what they do with it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, that doesn't row my canoe as hard, because I kind of feel like the Kubrick estate would be dumb to go like, well, Grandpa Stan would have wanted to tell Stephen King to F off. take your $2 billion and blow it out your ass. I'm an artiste. That's hard to do on behalf of your dead relative. But I don't know. I'm pretty pumped for that. I'm also like, there's also It Part Two on deck.
Yeah, that's another one that I read for the first time recently. I think I read that last year or the year before. And
I read that when I was 11 because I wasn't supervised.
See, the problem with It is that in the book, obviously, you're getting both halves of the story simultaneously. So you've got the 1950s flashback, you've got the contemporary flash forward, and in the book they're being told at the same time. So you're going to hit the apex of each story at the same time in the novel. What they've done is they've split that up between the two movies, where the first movie was the old flashback, and then it's going to be the new contemporary hotness. The new contemporary hotness story was not my favorite story in that. I definitely keyed in more with the flashback kind of childhood nostalgia stuff. And so while I'm really interested to see what they do with this, I thought the first one was great. I'm going to buy a ticket for the second one. But I do worry a little bit about content and telling a compelling story. I don't think it's going to punch as hard as wide of an audience.
And the other thing the book had is the book had a lot of sort of interlude in it,
mm-hmm.
that is a little harder to execute. Like the Tim Curry miniseries did try to do some of the stuff where like it's talking to Butch in prison,
uh-huh.
and some of that other stuff where they show how it kind of corrupts the whole town. There's a Stephen King universe.
Right.
Well,
and it's important to contextualize. One of the things I liked about It, the book, is there's a lot of library research. There's a lot of combing through old history records and getting stories from the old man who lives down the road. And there's a lot of that building the history that this evil force attacks the town once every so many years. And it traces it back, and there's one awful story that they tell in there about a black enlisted men's club that they kind of throw up a tar paper shack, and they couldn't hang out at the NCO club, so they said, well, here, go build yourself a shack out in the Tulies, and that's where you guys can hang out. Well, then everybody wanted to start hanging out there because they had the good music, and they had fun, and, like, they had all their jazz players and this, that, and the other.
Devil's lettuce.
And there was one night where a group of racists torched the place with a bunch of people inside. It is said in the book that one of the people who survived that is not only the ancestors of one of the characters in It, but also Dick O'Halloran, who is the caretaker of the Overlook Hotel in The Shining.
I can remember when I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining. And for a long time, I thought it was just the two of us that had the shine to us. Just like you probably thought you was the only one. But there are other folks, though mostly they don't know it or don't believe it.
I'm also a tremendous fan of the speculative, the regulators / desolation, the two kind of weirdly braided novels that Stephen King wrote, where it was like, it's about like parallel realities or parallel incarnations of kind of the same souls as different roles. And they're very interesting to sit and read the two of them. But again, they're like, how would you film them? I, for what it's worth, I kind of like the Jimmy Smith's Tommyknockers adaption.
Oh, you know, I've never seen that one.
I don't think it would hold up well, but I remember actually being kind of wigged out by it when I was a kid. And the Tommyknockers has some crazy, which is it's actually a fairly basic kind of alien invasion concept.
Uh-huh.
But it has some creepy, because the means of infiltration is a machine in the ground that sends signals and kind of messes with the town's behavior. It really has that trademark King, like a kind of look into the domestic world of the cast.
Uh-huh.
And if you were kind of in a rough household, the aliens might make it a little rougher.
Yeah.
And so it really had that aspect where he explores kind of the grimmer, darker side of small town life. And also, you know, Jimmy Smith's, man.
Well, I'll tell you what, Matt, speaking of the grimmer, darker aspects of big city life.
The soft, furry underbelly.
Yeah, it's a white underbelly. We're going to move on to tonight's film, which is kind of a special one. This is a movie that was near and dear to my heart for many, many years. If there is a movie that I have seen into the triple digits, and that's not me putting on airs, that's not me trying to alpha dog you, Matt, I think I may have actually seen this movie up to 100 times. It was an early VHS purchase in my household, so I watched it a lot as a kid. And that's actually going to come into play in our analysis later. But we watched the seminal film from 1988, Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
It was aliens.
It was a giant alien killer space clown spider.
It was actually George Slakas. For those iceberg / cave dwellers that don't know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? It was an early and mostly successful attempt at the interlacing of live action and animation. It's a PI story, first and foremost, in the grand tradition of, Mickey Spillane or Spencer for Hire. Or I always name those two in that order. Quick, throw out some more.
Pat Novak for Hire, Samuel Spade, Private Eye.
Have a Gun, Will Travel.
Philip Marlowe.
Yeah, I love that. You ever watch Have Gun, Will Travel?
I never did.
The intro? Yeah. This is a precision machine barrel. It makes my handgun more accurate and faster firing than many others of its type.
I always assumed Have Gun, Will Travel was a Western.
It is, yeah.
Oh.
But it's it is, but it was like, it ran back to back with like the Wells Fargo Hour.
Oh, I see.
And they're very much, even though they're Westerns, they're certainly pulp PI stories. They're the hired man is told to do this and X unfolds from it. Like, they're very go get my daughter back, except instead of the cult in the 60s in California, it's the Indians or whatever, you know?
Yeah, okay. Well, taking a quick look at our synopsis for our film tonight, the down-and-out, hard-boiled private eye Eddie Valiant takes a snoop job from a shifty studio head where he takes photos proving infidelity between a Hollywood star and his nightclub singer wife. When the other man in the love triangle, a local manufacturing and land magnate, is found dead, the Hollywood star is quickly suspected of murder. With the probate and land holdings of the magnate in flux following his death, a section of Los Angeles is up for grabs. Meanwhile, Eddie has to prove the Hollywood star's innocence and expose a corrupt city official before the city official gentrifies a neighborhood of second-class citizens. By the way, did we mention that the Hollywood star is a cartoon rabbit?
For crying out loud, Roger! How many times do we have to do this damn scene? Raul! I'll be in my trailer! Taking a nap!
Excuse me,
please, Cuts. Raul! I can give you stars! Just drop the refrigerator in my head one more time!
Roger, I dropped it on your head 23 times already!
I can take it! Don't worry about me!
I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about the refrigerator!
This is the tale of an up-and-coming movie star named Roger Rabbit and a down-and-out private detective.
Stay out!
Named Eddie Valiant.
Ooga booga!
Every moment they were together was a new adventure in trouble.
Hide me, Eddie! Please!
It's a motion picture about friendship.
Eddie, get easy, will ya? Please, Eddie! Don't tell me you're making a big mistake!
Love. Compassion.
Well, I'm sorry I yanked your ears.
All the time you yanked my ears?
Murder.
Marvin Acme. A rabbit cacked him last night.
Remember, you never saw me.
Sex.
I'd do anything for my husband, Mr. Valiant. Anything.
And violence.
Tunes gets him every time.
You wouldn't have any idea where the rabbit might be.
Got a thing for rabbits, huh?
The whole thing stinks like yesterday's diapers.
It's a comedy a little different from all the rest.
I'm a pig!
I'm a toon! I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
But tell me, Eddie. Is that a rabbit in your pocket, or you just happy to see me?
Touchstone Pictures and Steven Spielberg present a Robert Zemeckis film.
We toons may act idiotic, but we're not stupid.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
This is a genre-bending movie that marries live action and traditional hand-drawn cell animation, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit is absolutely a film noir that's injected with the zany humor and characters of America's golden years of animation.
I guess the first thing we have to disclaim is that there's probably a few people that'll throw the baby out with the bathwater here. There's probably just a few people from the conceit does not work.
Mm-hmm.
There have been quite a few movies where there was some live-action animation interaction. This was not the first attempt.
No, actually, I mean, if you want to trace this back to its very beginnings, in an earlier episode, Matt, you were not here for this, but I think in the cutting room floor, and you can see this on a video on our Facebook page, we talk about the Alice shorts from Disney, which is where we first got Peg Leg Pete as a character, who was originally a bear. But that was an early experiment in live action married with animation, which dates back to pre-Mickey Mouse. And even one of the first character animations, Gertie the Dinosaur by Winsor McCay, was a marriage of live action and cartoons that were... The technology was not great, but what this is it manages to be that and break all of the conventions that had been set up for that.
Well, and here's the thing about it, too. Compared to the ones before and almost everything since.
Yeah, I'd say virtually everything since.
There was simply more money, time, and care put into this one, and it just looks better.
It does. Mm-hmm. I will say... like I said, I have watched this movie hundreds of times. I watched it on VHS. I watched it on DVD. Watched it a couple of times on streaming. I think this is the first time I ever watched it on an HD screen with an HD quality presentation. And I think for that viewing, for the first time, there was a couple things that jumped out at me as being, oh, that didn't look as good as I remembered it looking or whatever. But still, as you said, it looks better than virtually anything else that's become certainly before and since.
I'll say this. Even the things in it that are a little rough, like there's a part where a cartoon bouncer throws Eddie out of a bar. And you can sort of tell because he throws him bodily, you know, mm-hmm. several, probably 10 feet. Because he's a cartoon gorilla. And you can definitely sort of tell that he's in like a wire harness. But the thing about it is it's not, because it's only has to be as good as something that's fictional.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I don't really know how cartoon gorillas are supposed to throw guys out of places. And it looked good enough that I was, you're never like there isn't a slip bad enough to knock you all the way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's important. And there's a...
Well, and that's... This movie technically was... It was such a watershed in special effects movies. And it was something that when originally pitched, everybody kind of looked at each other and said, I get what you're asking for. I just don't know how to do it.
Well, and it's an adaptation of a comparatively obscure novel.
Yeah, and the novel itself is a little different, too, in that it's about humans interacting with cartoon characters, but they're comic strip characters that speak with word balloons, and they are photographed to make the Sunday funnies in the paper every week. And so even then it's not the most direct adaptation, you know, going back to Stephen King and The Shining.
Well, it's also quite like the book's a bit darker and has a nastier ending.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little more risque, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think there's some parts that even get kind of weird.
Well, and I believe the character of Jessica, who is Roger's cartoon human spouse, was a pornographic character in the novel. I believe she was intended as kind of a girly tune magazine centerfold for servicemen.
Yeah, like a Playboy cartoons type character. And also the ending is just, I think Roger dies in the end of the book.
I think they even played with that in the movie and decided against it.
And he's just too much the heart and soul of the 88 movie for them to have, I don't know. It might have been courageous, but I think it would have just been surly.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's weird. Some of the people who were not down with this movie when it came out were a lot of early animators, including Chuck Jones, famous animator Chuck Jones, who worked on the movie. And they said, this is too dark. This is not what these characters were intended for. This is kind of against their character. I didn't think so.
I don't know. I've seen some of those things Chuck Jones worked on. But, you know. kind of like old Uncle Morrissey slipping off into the dark. We don't talk about it.
Well, the animation director here I wanted to point out specifically was Richard Williams. And the reason I wanted to bring him up, number one, he's the person who told Robert Zemeckis, who is the director of the film. Zemeckis says, well, we're not supposed to be able to move the camera. We're not supposed to be able to rotate the camera. The blocking of cartoons was usually very static back then because it's hard to animate a two-dimensional character in a 3D space, especially when you're dealing with hand-drawn animation. And Richard Williams was actually the guy who told Robert Zemeckis, no, we can absolutely do that. It's just hard. It's just not done because it's difficult and time-consuming and expensive, but we have the time and the money to do this. Absolutely, we can do it.
And then for cinematography, they got someone that had worked with effects before.
Yeah. Cinematography by Dean Cundey. Worked with Zemeckis previously on Back to the Future. Also worked with John Carpenter on Escape from New York and The Thing.
Boy, this movie we're hiding in is great.
Also did the cinematography on Roadhouse.
Well, nobody ever complained about the cinematography on Roadhouse.
Real quick, just to circle back to Richard Williams, the reason I wanted to bring him up, number one, he did a fantastic job on this movie. Like, the animation being sold in this movie it could make or break it. Like, there's a reason that we watch this movie now and not Cool World. But Richard Williams had a passion project for several years. It eventually got released widely under the name The Thief and the Cobbler. But it was a movie that, like Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind, had kind of a long, long production history where he was self-financing, would run out of money, have to fundraise some more, was doing a lot of the work on his own. I think Vincent Price recorded his voice in this movie back in the 70s, and the movie, I think, finally got released in the mid-90s. But it was this long, troubled production on this movie, and even if you find a DVD copy of this now, the movie got taken away from him eventually and was finished by a group of investors, and it's kind of one of those things where the story behind the movie is actually a little bit better than the movie itself, just because you watch The Thief and the Cobbler and you're like, this was absolutely screwed with. Like, I can see the seams. I can see where the professional animation team took over, and this doesn't look as cool as this. And it's kind of a hot mess, but it's an interesting story worth looking into.
I've never even heard of that. You've stumped the chump.
Enter an enchanted kingdom where a clever thief and a simple cobbler are about to become the heroes of the winner of the 1995 Academy of Family Films Award, The Thief and the Cobbler.
Have no fear. We are safe from any threat as long as those three golden balls are on the minaret.
It's the magical story of a brave young boy, a daring thief, and a beautiful princess.
What is your name?
Tack.
Who team up with some funny new friends.
Hear what happens when you don't finish school.
To battle a wicked sorcerer.
The world is mine to take. The balls are gone!
So, Matt, the marriage here, I mean, like, there are so many ways that this shouldn't work, but it does. Because we've got this hard-boiled, kind of almost two-color film noir.
Well, actually, that's why what I think is perfect.
Yeah?
Is that we're introduced to all this through the lens of somebody who's super jaded with it.
Mm-hmm.
So our main character is a guy that he doesn't even really want to look at one of these happy-go-lucky living cartoons.
Uh-huh.
And every time he sees one, he's just like, fuck. God, oh, he's going to do the joy buzzer. He's going to do the meep, meep, meep and run away. He's going to do the... At one point, he orders a scotch from a penguin waiter, and he says, I'll have a scotch on the rocks. And the waiter waddles away like three steps, and he goes, I mean ice, damn it. There's a lot of good old dad joke tier puns in this.
Yeah.
That are pretty great.
Well, we'll get to it in a minute, but a lot of those I always took as just cheap jokes. Like, because I saw this when I was a kid. I saw this when it was in the theater. And I never really allowed my observation to go beyond that. And I think I missed a lot of, like, really buried humor and really buried subtext in this.
But animation-wise, there's a few points where you see, like, a border or an edge or something. Or
mm-hmm.
Anytime a toon kind of full body interacts with someone smaller than it, like there's a part where they ride in a toon car.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little roughness, but it's not bad. It's not distracting. And then there's some stuff that at one point Jessica Rabbit is a lounge singer and she serenades Eddie. She is animated and he is, I don't know, not.
Live action.
I was almost going to say he was real, but I thought that was like tunist. But while she sings to him, like she takes his hat on and off of his head and she plays with his tie and stuff. And I believe she was rotoscoped in that scene. I think they had a woman sing the song and do the moves.
Uh-huh.
And tried to have her do it at like a quarter speed and then rotoscope over it with no shakes. And it looks pretty plausible.
Well, and you have stuff like even just the character of Baby Herman, who is a anthropomorphized 50-year-old man trapped in a, you know, cartoon baby body.
Who has the dirtiest line in the movie.
Yeah, he has a couple of them. And he's sitting there smoking a photorealistic stogie. And so you watch some of the special features on this. You can find them on YouTube, or I believe there is actually a special feature edition that you can buy off of Amazon. And they actually have a robotic arm that is attached to a sensor where a live actor is moving it around. And it's moving the robotic arm in tandem with that. And then they go in and paint the animation cells over the top of that robot.
That's like, I don't know if you watched the extras when you watched Child's Play 1.
I haven't, no.
The number of people it took to animate, like the crew that made the Chucky doll move.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, wow, they would do that different today.
I'm going to keep saying it, and I just lack the vocabulary to really put it across, but the achievement of this film just from a technical aspect. I mean, this could be the most boring story in the world, and it would still be a jaw-dropping special effects film. There is this apocryphal story that's told, and you can see the scene in the movie. There's not much to doubt about this, but there's a scene where Eddie and Roger are handcuffed together, and he runs him into an old rot gut room in the back of the bar, and he whips him out of his coat, and as he does, he bumps a hanging lamp that swings wildly around as he throws Roger in, and the scene commences. Well, what we don't notice, and we would notice if it didn't happen, but what's going on there is they bumped this lamp, and that is constantly changing the lighting in the room. And so all of the shading, all of the shadow, all of that on Roger had to be meticulously painted on and paid attention to, and make sure the light source is coming from the right place and is matching the scene around it. And I think for maybe what's on screen for just a couple of seconds is this marvel of animation that the layperson isn't going to notice. And so that's kind of the shorthand. And there's a Hollywood term now called bumping the lamp, which is going the extra mile to do that thing that the audience isn't going to notice. And that's the old adage is, it's not the things that the audience notices, it's the things that they don't. They just make this feel really real, really lived in, you know?
Yeah, I remember when you and I worked on TV news and something would be going wrong on the TV news.
Yeah.
And we'd be flying off the handle in the control room, and then it was like, later when you saw it in real time, you realized it was just like, oh, a graphic was 3 font points to the left.
Yeah. There were a couple of attempts, as you said, after this to kind of play on this style. Cool World comes to mind. That's the one that came out a few years later. Had Brad Pitt in it. It was animated by Ralph Bakshi, who we discussed on the show years ago, who did American Pop. And you can just tell, like, they didn't take as much time with it. It's a cool-looking movie. But you can tell when Brad Pitt puts his arm around one of the tunes in that movie, it doesn't quite have the same weight. It doesn't quite have the same feel to it. And that's just something that Roger Rabbit, the team, seems to have nailed that nobody has really been able to nail since. And I'll even call out, like, I am just behind or ahead of the game. I was just a hair too old to be the target demographic for Space Jam. And while I think they're integrated very well, live action to animation in there, it's still Michael Jordan just can't give that Bob Hoskins performance, you know?
Except for the parts Corey Coleman worked on. Those were great.
I don't know, Matt. Do you remember either of those movies? Cool World or Space Jam?
Cool World I actually had cause to watch recently.
Oh, yeah?
Cool World is also one of the only films my mother has got up and left the building with me. And,
oh, that's right. Yeah. I forgot about that story.
Because she just saw it was like a cartoon. It was like, oh, I'll take the little whippersnapper to a cartoon. And that cartoon had PG-13 boobies in it.
Yes, it did. That cartoon had salacious Kim Basinger.
Yeah, although... I don't know. It wasn't as good as Batman.
A few things are. Most of the Batman movies aren't as good as Batman.
Did you see the meme that was? It was the Dark Knight Joker. You know how I got these scars? And then it was an otter pop with sharp sides.
So, Matt, what we're really dealing with in Roger Rabbit is we have three films going on here. We've got our period film noir. We've got our special effects tentpole film. And we've got our madcap animated feature. And this movie had to deal with all of those. They had to dress a set like you would for a full production on a period film noir. They had to animate virtually every scene in the film. And it was a giant budget special effects movie that they had to make some money back on. So do you think all of those came off?
I kind of do. And the reason they all work is that they all cover for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, it's not the real period, because this is some other timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Where toons are alive, and maybe that period of Hollywood lasted a little longer. And so we've liberated ourselves slightly from the strict rules of the period piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's obviously a behind the scenes look at the actual personalities of the fictive animated characters. So they're not required to stay in character and in lane all the time. Although Roger kind of does.
Mm-hmm.
Roger seems to be like kind of a Toons tune, you know, like, cause he never gives up on Eddie.
No.
And then what grounds it all is that the noir frame is something we've seen 100 times or more.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a pretty basic, it's so basic. We even know the misdirects. We know that both cases will be one case.
Uh-huh.
That at first we're going to want to blame it on the dame, but it's probably not really her. you know, and then, at the end, it's going to be a big double cross.
Right.
You know. And it's all there, lined out just like it is in 100 other movies. And then it in turn is lent novelty by this cartoon aspect.
Uh-huh.
And given a little cover of distraction for the magician to work his magic. And it all comes across pretty good.
Yeah, I think so too. I think this movie holds up. I think this movie was fantastic at the time. And I think really it ages well. Like, there's still a lot being talked about in this movie subtextually that we're still talking about today socially.
You know what I would like to stack up against this if we were doing a two-parter?
What was that?
It's the Dick Tracy movie.
Yeah. That came out, I think, like a year later, too. It was...
'Cause I have a feeling that has not aged as well.
Probably not, but yeah, there was something about that movie, wasn't there?
Yeah, there's a little something called Madonna.
Sooner or later, you're gonna be mine. Sooner or later, you're gonna be mine. Baby, it's time that you faced it. I always get my mind.
Well, Matt, I do have to confess, like I said, I've seen this movie so many times, and we talk about on the show every now and then that we always make it a point to watch the movie before we talk about it, but every now and then we run across a film that we've seen so many times, we probably could do the episode without having to watch it.
Or another thing that happens a lot is one of us will bring up a movie that we just watched.
Yeah.
And so it'll take the other person a week to watch it, and then we refuse to get locked in an endless spiral of one of us watching it each weekend.
Well, what I have to tell you, Matt, for as much as I literally have major swaths of this movie memorized by rote. I have music cues and transitions like branded into my head. But on this watch, and it's because I was watching it for the podcast with kind of an analytical eye, I caught so much in this, and it's obvious stuff. Big obvious stuff that I'm sure people have been seeing for years. This was the first time I am ever like, oh my God, I never thought of this under any other terms than just kind of a silly cartoon movie. There's a lot going on in this movie subtextually that I just never really, I don't know, maybe I noticed or maybe I just didn't give full consideration, but it's something on this time around hit me pretty good.
Well, yeah, and I was noticing a little... kind of some new stuff that would not have occurred to me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Like Jessica Rabbit's backing band.
Yeah.
Is clearly, it's, It's three black birds, and they're wearing sunglasses, and they have droopy hand-rolled cigarettes.
Yeah.
They are a jazz band on the Jazz Cabbage.
And you look at the rest of the film. I mean, that's an overt... I mean, it is a trope in Roger Rabbit because it was a trope of cartoons in the 40s that black birds like that were kind of... I'm talking about the birds in Dumbo.
Yeah, and also there was Heckle and Jekyll that were...
Yeah, and...
Basically what we're tiptoeing around is that, like, at some point watching this, like, I texted Trevor and then he texted me back almost at the same time, like, are the tunes, like, black vaudevillians?
I mean, that's... I don't know. And see, I didn't necessarily want to take it to any one specific race or culture or anything. I think it's...
Well, and it's not one specific one. Like, the weasels are zoot suited.
Yeah.
But there's quite a lot of implication going on with the tunes and, like, just generally. And I don't think it was meant to be specifically X, Y, or Z, but they're talking a lot about the exploitation of the Hollywood system. Of the, you know, the writer and the singer and the performer and the, because those were not the kindest days in Hollywood.
No. So really, this movie, if you replace the tunes with any other kind of oppressed culture, you're going to have to rewrite some of the dialogue for sure. But the plot beats in this work just as well. And
hey, man, Total Recall is Who Framed Roger Rabbit with mutants.
But this was kind of like the first time this occurred to me that Toontown is not a magical, whimsical place where the toons live and come from. That is the section of town where they are told they can live. You know, it's not like everybody, all of the Chinese immigrants that came into L.A. at a certain time said, oh, we're just going to live in the same neighborhood and have this really culturally specific neighborhood that's got its own ethnic makeup and cultural background. No, they were kind of told where they had to live. And
I don't think it necessarily, like, I don't think anybody said from the second block north to the 10th block west, there be Chinatown.
Yeah.
But the situation evolves. Mm-hmm. And it's a confluence of cheap rent, and then once you get off and you get into an area where the signs are in your native language, and you can find a translator, and you can find someone to help you with your, you know, you can find work without learning a new language right away. So then you get those little Chinas and little Italys and
Well, and I specifically bring up Chinatown in L.A. because this movie shares a lot in common with a movie named Chinatown, which is also a private eye film noir film starring a young Jack Nicholson.
I think he said Death Rabbits.
That's our last bowl.
We can never go back to Arizona.
Chinatown was a film featuring a star turn for Jack Nicholson. It was part of a planned noir detective trilogy.
Oh, if anybody got those references, send us a Facebook post and we'll recognize you somehow. Probably not financially.
Chinatown, star turn for Jack Nicholson was part of a planned detective noir trilogy. Chinatown was the first. Eventually, we got the sequel, The Two Jakes. The third film, which was discussed, was never made. The name of that movie was Cloverleaf and was going to deal in the, Chinatown, it was based on the California Water Wars, deals heavily in infidelity. There's, the murder of one of the people in the infidelist triangle, deals largely in public utilities and the tragic death in a culturally diverse part of LA. And then this was a movie, instead of about water, it was about transportation. And in a way, as much as Stanley Kubrick's The Shining was based on the Stephen King book, The Shining, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was based on a true story. The undermining of public transit by auto manufacturers and other private interests was a real thing back then.
Yeah, back then. Thank God it's over.
Well, that was another joke that I caught. Now that I have lived out in L.A., you know, now that I have that history behind me, there's a line that Eddie Valiant has in here.
8 smooth, unblocked lanes. Traffic jams will be a thing of the past. That's what you're coming up with.
No, it's the who needs a car in L.A. when we have the best public transportation system in the world? Nobody in L.A. today is going to say that.
Yeah, that's actually something that previous viewings I would have taken on him. I would have believed him to be being sarcastic.
Uh-huh.
And because every time I watch this, I forget the actual plot.
Right.
But the it definitely always takes from Chinatown the structure of a detective hired to do something to validate a motive for a murder that is something other than the actual giant swindle that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in what is the triangle? It's Roger, R.K. Maroon of Maroon Cartoons.
No, it's Roger, Marvin Acme, and Jessica.
Yeah, yeah. But then, and they catch him. I love the device of catching them playing patty cake.
Take comfort, son. You're not the first man his wife baked patty cake on him.
I just don't believe it. I won't believe it. I can't believe it. I shan't believe it.
Believe it, kid. I took the pictures myself. She played patty cake.
That was funny for me as a kid. And I think it's a good kind of tongue-in-cheek way of saying that they were sleeping around together. And there is the actual joke that they are literally playing the game patty cake. But you also have to see this from a motivational standpoint, where Roger, even though it is just a game of patty cake, he feels so betrayed.
Well, and of course, also the character of Roger,
mm-hmm.
I don't think, it seems to me that and we don't get a lot of mechanism here. We don't dig mm-hmm. in. We don't dig into how. Where do the tunes come from? Do they spring forth from Toontown, or have they been confined there?
Yeah.
Or there is a slight. To me, it seems there's a slight implication that Toontown is the wellspring of them.
Uh huh.
And so it's Acme having a monopoly. He owns the piece of property and can thus effectively have leverage licensing all tunes.
Mm-hmm.
I took that by implication, but we don't learn what two tunes do when the lights are off. We also don't know what Jessica would do with a human.
Right.
It's implied that things would proceed more or less normally, but we don't get into the mechanics of it. So for all we know, doing innocent cartoon things like patty cake with someone else could be, it could be like they're like the way an exotic dancer will tell you no kissing.
Right.
I've heard.
In the way I kind of interpreted it this time was that tunes were almost created. And again, this is my headcanon. Again, you know, all of this is implicit and none of it is discussed. But I believe that the tunes are created by artists. They're ink and paint. Like the dip that Judge Doom uses to dispense executions on the tunes is acetone, benzene, and something else. And those are all paint thinners. So, like, the tunes are actual ink and paint, somehow animated and brought to life. But I think there is a little bit, on top of everything else, of a creator-creation kind of Mary Shelley story going here. I think the reason that the tunes are the oppressed culture is because they're not viewed as actual people. They're creations. They're there to do the bidding of their creators. There's a line in here, and this is a perfect example of what I'm talking about, is there's the shifty cartoon magnate that Eddie is working for is R.K. Maroon, and he makes the comment at one point that he's got a bunch of Disney's characters on contractual loan, and he makes the joke they work for peanuts, and he throws a handful of peanuts out the window. And Dumbo flies by and sucks up the peanuts into his trunk and soars away. And that's a great dad joke, but that line is so loaded. He is actually making commentary on the fact that they can get content out of these tunes without actually having to pay them.
Which is good. You know, like the Oh Brother Where Art Thou, the man up there says you sing in a can, he'll give you $20.
Yeah.
You know, and that's... I think that's kind of all, it's kind of all in there. And I actually, there's a, every once in a while when we get to arguing about that certain thing we sometimes argue about, I try to get you to read Free Culture by Lawrence Lessig.
Uh-huh.
And it has a whole thing in it about the irony of the studio system being as the West Coast studios were actually started to break contracts with the East Coast studios.
Uh-huh.
And so like there's a cycle of upheaval and disruption in this what is actually a fairly young industry. If you think about it, like we think of them as an American cultural institution and contribution, but the motion picture industry is not an industry like the steel industry. It's a young industry where we don't have to really seed the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that's like if you get around the world of film, you find out it does have some strange old rules. To say nothing of like the first time someone explained to me like a union carpenter's follow along, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know? Like there are some strange ins and outs to the biz, which of course I talk like we know what we're talking about, but we mostly just, I don't know. I think I'd be typecasted as like poker buddy number three.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably both of us.
Guy with rake.
Well, and that's in the studio.
Oh, a tiger shark.
That's the thing. In the studio system, you used to get hired at a studio and they would put you in, wherever they could. And so, you know, Matt and I would have a certain physical type, so we have to show up for the Palooka roles, 9 to 5. We're going to go play Roman Palookas in this movie, and then the next day we might be playing Old West Palookas over here. And you worked for your studio. They just kind of put you wherever they wanted you. And there was a lot of abuse at that time because people would sign a contract to be a Palooka, but then they end up being a big star, but they're locked into a kind of a meager contract where the studio will pay for their housing, they'll pay for their food, they'll pay for their booze, and if you kill a hooker in your room that night, they might cover that up too. But as far as getting that house in Malibu, that's not on the table. And I think that's supported here again in Roger Rabbit. Betty Boop is a character in this film. She is a big star. People know who she is. She had name brand recognition in her heyday, but she makes the point that she is black and white. When cartoons went to color, I stopped getting work.
Cigars, cigarettes, Betty Valiant.
Betty?
Long time no see.
What are you doing here?
Work's been kind of slow since cartoons went to color, but I still got it, Eddie.
Yeah, you still got it.
And now she's a cigarette girl at a human-only club.
The quote-unquote ink and paint club where the humans come to see the tune review that has to come in the back door.
Yeah, it is specifically said, you know, this is a humans-only club tune review with, they're serving the drinks, they're mixing the bar, they're the ones up on stage, but they do not get to participate as audience, which yet again is another example of something that happened a lot in Hollywood with oppressed cultures.
Well, and then to the arc of this movie itself and to the arc of like Eddie Valiant, this is the first, and maybe it was that HD factor,
mm-hmm.
or maybe it's the fact that I'm one to still be settling in for my popcorn, but the office montage of... There's a scene where like... probably 20 years of the life of Eddie and his missing brother, Teddy, are exposited. And you see them, their father was a clown.
Mm-hmm, at the Ringling Brothers Circus, yeah.
And brought them up through clown school. And then for whatever reason, they ended up in the police academy instead. And they serve as cops and they're honorably discharged. And they start a detective agency. And they are detectives to the tune stars, brother and brother. And then in what is like the very exploration of that, when it happens to you, it's, when I stub my toe, it's tragedy. When you get hit by a safe, it's comedy. A tune off screen before the story starts, has killed Eddie's brother with, dropping a piano on him.
Yes.
And then we also get into like, there's even parts with like, where Eddie's interacting with Roger, where you sort of get tune phobia because you like hear it. Like there's one part where he's handcuffed to Roger Defiant One style for a while.
Yeah.
And you get like, Roger keeps doing madcap things and Eddie's body can't do them.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait a minute, how? And then, when Eddie's about to hacksaw off the cuffs. Roger, and he can't get an angle on it. Roger goes, would this help? And he pulls his hand out of the cuff. And Eddie says, you mean to tell me you could have pulled your hand out of there at any time? And he goes,
not at any time, only when it's funny.
Yeah. And so you start to question, like, how does the physics of this actually, what is the metaphysics of these creatures? Like,
yeah.
Maybe it would be bad if they ran amok, you know? Mm-hmm. And you go, what am I saying? Am I part of the Sentinel program for Toons? Wait, are Toons mutants? What?
I'm glad you brought up Eddie and especially his kind of relationship, because I think it's important to see that there's just that one photo in that kind of long pan in that scene where you just see Eddie, the brother Teddy, and they're going to dad for a day at work. And it's them at the Ringling Brothers Circus, and they're all dressed up as clowns. You think about what the timing of that would have been. That would have probably predated any kind of animation as...
That paper is dated 1908.
Okay, so yeah, that would be right around the time that cartoons were coming onto the scene. That's when Winsor McCay was starting to play with animation. And what happens to the circus clowns in a world where you can literally drop a safe on a rabbit for comedic effect? So I think, in a way, Eddie grew up as his version of a toon, and then the real toons came in and took that role in society. Now, what I wanted to talk about Eddie specifically, though, is I think he is the perfect example of kind of... The term en vogue currently is kind of diet racist, but it's that thing we've talked about on the show before. It's not the guy living next door, it's the ones on TV. Eddie's very much that type of person. He has toon friends. He'll say that he's not racist because he has toon friends. He worked with the toons. He's sexually attracted to a toon, but they make him absolutely furious because of this one bad experience he had. And it was traumatic. He lost a family member in it, but he kind of saddled the whole culture with this one bad thing that happened because a toon did this to my brother. To hell with all the rest of the toons. But Eddie knows how to work those physics. He knows how to make a weasel laugh. He knows how to tumble. He knows how to juggle. He knows how, when he's trying to get Roger to do something, to start an argument and do the old rabbit season, duck season thing with him, and that's how you get through. He's actually, from his history of working with toons, he knows how to be a toon. And it's kind of his rediscovery of their humanity that really helps him. That's kind of his art.
Drink the drink.
But I don't want the drink.
He doesn't want the drink.
He does.
I don't.
You do.
I don't.
You do.
I don't.
You do.
I don't.
You don't.
I do.
You don't.
I do.
You don't.
Listen, when I say I do, that means I do.
Well, and it's implied, I don't know about you, but you tell me what you think.
Uh-huh.
It is, to me, another thing that occurred to me in this one is I had always took Roger and Eddie to be perfect strangers at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the more, and I haven't watched this since probably 1998.
Uh-huh.
So late high school for me. But so like the more I thought about like Roger's behavior, and Roger is obnoxious because he's a ball of chaos like Bugs Bunny.
Right.
Although he's a little more, whatever the portmanteau, whatever the ratio of other characters is, he's not as mean as Bugs Bunny.
Uh-huh.
But he's trying very hard to snap Eddie out of whatever's wrong with Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
And we also get a great supporting human character in Eddie's girlfriend.
Dolores, yeah.
And who, again, in that photo montage, we learn that at one point, the Valiants had a successful Valiant and Valiant detectives. And she was the office manager or secretary or Gal Friday. So you get where, and the other thing is like, Eddie's always trying to shut Roger up, and he's always shorter with Roger than the people around him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the one, he leaves the room, he comes back, Roger's singing and dancing, and everybody's having a good time, and Eddie puts the kibosh on it. You got to be more under the radar than that. You got to be, what are you crazy? We're trying to hide out here, you know? And so I took away from this one, like maybe they're even pre-acquainted. They rub shoulders at some point in the past. Because Roger does come to Eddie like, Eddie, you're the only one that can help me. Like he knows him.
Well, and if you look at, again, a lot of this is inferential storytelling. And not all of it is in that montage, but he Valiant and Valiant cleared Goofy of spy charges at one point. I think there was a kidnapping of Huey, Dewey, and Louie that they solved. And at another point, Eddie has this kind of a ceremonial gift of a toon gun that if you pay attention, the plaque on the outside says, thanks for keeping me out of the Who's Gow signed Yosemite Sam. So Eddie has worked with some name brand big stars. So if Roger didn't know Eddie personally, he certainly would have known him by reputation.
Well, yeah. And then there's, I think what's going on, and like, for me, the first time I watched this, Eddie drinking and stuff was just like a trope.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like Time and Tide have turned those things a little more serious for me.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely see like in this movie, you see the moment where he like salvages a bunch of his relationships.
Yeah.
And Roger really does kind of save him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, we have barely touched on the antagonist.
Okay.
We got to mention.
Got to mention the unflappable Christopher Lloyd as one Judge Doom.
I am looking for murder.
Which I wasn't really clear on the legal system because he seemed to have kind of a untouchable sort of deal going on where he is this guy that's been given sort of the concession on law enforcement in Toontown.
Mm-hmm.
And he has as his flunkies, he has cartoon weasels who are of limited utility. But and he has come up with, apparently previously, there were very few ways to kill a toon. You had to sort of kill them canonically with some sort of weakness of their subspecies of toon. For example, weasels can laugh themselves to death.
Yeah.
But if you tried normal, what in Dungeons and Dragons terms you'd call bludgeoning, piercing, and slashing damage, it seemed to have very little effect on them, and they would do things like you would run over them and they would just reinflate themselves. And so this Judge Doom has come up with the dip. And the dip is very thinly veiled reference, as we were talking about before, to paint remover.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put a toon in the dip, the toon dissolves. Now, I don't know about you, but I think on the one of the pieces of unintentional nightmare fuel that many people our age saw as a kid is when this is demonstrated,
little squeaky shoe.
Since I've had Toontown under my jurisdiction, my goal has been to rein in the insanity, and the only way to do that is to make toons respect the law.
Judge Doom dips a cartoon shoe with probably roughly the IQ of a dog. So it's kind of like he drowns a puppy on screen to make a point.
How did that gargoyle get to be a judge?
Spread a bunch of simoleons around Toontown a couple years back. Bought the election.
Huh? What's that?
Remember how we always thought there wasn't a way to kill a toon? Well, Doom found the way. Turpentine, acetone, benzene. He calls it the dip.
I'll catch the rabbit, Mr. Valiant. Then I'll try him, convict him, and execute him.
Yeah.
And the poor little squeaky shoe goes out bad.
Yeah. It's well, and then the second thing I think is at the end, you know, spoiler alert, but at the end of the film, Judge Doom is run over by a steamroller. And then we find out as he wirily hops back up and reinflates himself that Judge Doom is actually a toon in human disguise. But Christopher Lloyd getting run over by that steamroller is a lot.
You gotta disguise to look like human, guys, but you're not a man. You're a
pigeon,
boo.
That's a chicken.
I was associating with the good feathers. Who want to perch on Scorsese's head.
You know, I believe in the original, like there's several different versions of this script, but I believe some of the stories that were pitched, there was going to be a reveal on Judge Doom where they unmasked him as the guy who shot Bambi's mother.
Well, and there was a version where Jessica was the double crosser.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it just, well, and Judge Doom was terrifying anyway. Christopher Lloyd, I guess, during the course of his performance, made it a point to never blink on screen. And I never actually caught the foreshadowing of the glass eyeballs that he stumbles on in the movie. He kind of, it's like, it's the old marble gag. There's a bunch of glass eyeballs on the ground and he slips and falls. And then he pops back up and he's holding his hand over his eye like he's injured. Well, the actual inference there is that, no, one of his glass eyes has fallen out and is amongst those on the floor. He has to run around back and pop another one in.
Yeah, it's quite, and then when he turns out to be the sort of weird hybrid passing as a human tune, he's pretty disturbing.
Yeah. Well, and it turns out he is the tune that killed Eddie's brother.
Well, it's implied that this is fairly deviant and that not many tunes do this type of thing.
Right.
The final kind of action sequence where they fight in the Acme, because Marvin Acme sold jokes and magic tricks in addition to tunes.
Well, all the things that Wile E. Coyote sends away for from the Acme company show up here. So you've got oversized magnets, you've got giant wooden mallets, you've got, you know, comical boxing gloves, anvils, pianos, a ton of bricks.
Which isn't actually that many bricks. But so they fight in this warehouse full of animated and not animated joke products. Like there's a singing sword.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of these, if you're familiar with Warner Brothers cartoons, are fairly specific references to specific cartoons. And then ultimately, like, to defeat the weasels, Eddie has to unleash his inner clowning and make them all laugh. And then he has to fight Judge Doom. And the fight with Judge Doom is actually pretty... Like, Judge Doom has, like a power saw for a hand. And he talks like this. And then there's also, like, a beeline plot with the will.
Yes. Well, and that's the kind of weird gentrification storyline that's really where this gets a lot of the comparison to Chinatown, is that the MacGuffin in all of this is Marvin Acme's will. Marvin Acme plays Patty Cake with Jessica. The Roger is then framed for Marvin Acme's murder. And the whole ploy is that Judge Doom, who is actually a corrupt official, is trying to get his hands on Toontown and RK Maroon Studios so that he can build a freeway through the city of Los Angeles.
Which, and we really don't know quite if there's a thing here that might have been explored a little more. It's I don't know if it's just straight up self-loathing or what, but but he wants to shut down the whole, maybe he's against toonsploitation.
Maybe.
But he wants to shut the whole industry down and plow under both establishments. And then you find out that he is the stockholder of the Cloverleaf Company.
Mm-hmm.
In that reference to the third Robert Town movie that's been buying up just bought the city trolley to shut it down.
Mm. And so as far as plot goes, I'd say that this plot was fairly complex, especially for a movie that I enjoyed this much as an 8-year-old kid. I'm not going to say it's as complex as The Big Sleep, but it's definitely a little more involved than The Maltese Falcon.
Which makes a quick guest appearance as Eddie's hat rack.
Yeah, I saw that. There are so many just like little inside jokes and things like that, because there's the one I pointed out to you, too. There's a scene where Eddie has to take some salacious photos from a window that's abutting an alley. And the window is just a little too tall for Eddie, so he pulls out and stands on a literal apple box to get the photos. What's funny about that is an apple box is a piece of equipment from the Grip Crew that is a wooden box that you use to change the levels on things. And it got that name as a colloquialism, but the thing he pulls out is the size and shape of a Grips apple box, but it is literally a box of apples that you might find in an old 1940s Depression era alleyway. And so just little things like that, it is so insider Hollywood. It is so into its own kind of trope as a film noir.
Well, and
there's so many old jokes and cameos and things just relating to old cartoons.
Well, like the whole genre of the Baby Herman,
yeah,
Roger Rabbit cartoon is essentially a type of, like, we saw that with Tom and Jerry.
Tom and Jerry and Popeye did that a lot.
Yeah, with the baby's day out where they're told to... Although that was the strangest looking tune in Toontown.
Yeah.
Because, so Roger and Baby Herman are kind of to scale. Baby Herman is toddler-sized. Roger is Roger-sized. And when the obligatory scene from cartoons where the mom that towers out of the screen gives them and she tells Roger to be a good babysitter and then she's going to go do whatever. And I'm just sitting there thinking, like, so is there a 10-foot-tall lady tune?
They actually explain this. If you pay attention in the background, when Roger is the director is storming off, there is a guy on two giant tunes, woman's leg stilts, and he's pulling a dress off. And so it's human guy with two giant tune lady legs.
But then are those legs sentient tunes?
That's the question.
I don't want to think about it. I do want to think about it.
I mean, if the shoes were sentient shoes, manufactured at the Acme...
Just a couple of sentient feet and calves. I'm just saying, like, Toontown might have a real weird Diagon Alley.
Go down the right back alley in Toontown, you can find anything.
Just a couple of little kismet notes. Robert Zemeckis and Dean Cundey both worked on Back to the Future 2. That movie also featured music, as in the case of Who Framed Roger Rabbit by Alan Silvestri. Both of those movies also feature the River Road Tunnel, which is up in Griffith Park in Los Angeles. In this movie, it's the tunnel entrance to Toontown, and in the Back to the Future 2, it's the tunnel that Marty has to hoverboard through as he's being chased by Biff. And in both films, Christopher Lloyd is waiting at the other side of the tunnel to make an unexpected appearance.
God, let's just fuse all those characters together. Dr. Doom can show up and stop Biff from being president with his saw hand.
Well, it goes even deeper than that. So the film before this was Back to the Future Part 1. In both Back to the Future and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, we have occurrences of the following lines. Didn't hear you come in. You're a sight for sore eyes. I'm gonna ram him. And as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, so we were... Those are things that people say with their mouth holes.
Dude, if you ever want to just get frustrated reading a trivia section, read the trivia section for Roger Rabbit, because according to the IMDb trivia section, every actor on the planet was considered for either Judge Doom or Eddie Valiant. Like, we're talking everybody from Eddie Murphy to Tim Curry. Like, Tim Curry's audition for Judge Doom was apparently too terrifying. But, this was not for as strong... of a performance as this is by Bob Hoskins. And for as strong of a performance, I think this is probably Bob Hoskins' best movie. Like,
I'll come with you, Judge Doom, on, on one condition. What's that, Roger? I get to kill the unicorn.
All right, Matt. Well, any if-then recommendations this evening?
Ooh, I don't care. I'm recommending Brick.
All right. Any particular reason? I mean, I know the reason, but do you want to tell folks at home?
It is another skewed noir. So it's a noir with a setting and genre twist as spackle.
Mm-hmm.
Brendan?
Emily?
I really screwed up.
Screwed up how?
The brick.
What?
I didn't know it was bad, but the pin's on it now. You gotta help me.
Slow down now. This isn't good. No.
Emily said words I didn't know. Tell me if they catch.
Brick?
No.
Tug?
Tug might be a drink, like milk and vodka.
Pin? You know the kingpin. Dope runner, right?
Big time. What are you gonna do?
She asked for my help. I just want to know she's okay.
So what's first?
I'm gonna start shaking things up.
I would probably, in that vein, go with The Big Lebowski, which we have also done an episode on. I'm gonna leave Chinatown off the list just because we've talked about it so much that should just... Nobody gets that one. The other two I'm going to recommend, if the kind of mismatched pair is your thing, I've got a couple recommendations there. Number one, Turner and Hooch, which is a delightful little mismatched 80s cop comedy where Tom Hanks plays against a large drooling animal, not unlike Roger Rabbit. And I'm... Matt, I'm so torn over this one because I want to mention it. We've covered it on the show. We didn't love it. We both kind of like were over the hump on recommending it. But I think, honestly, this is in the same vein. And I think there's probably going to be some common audience over here overlap. So I'm just going to say it. I'm going to say Bright, which is another kind of we're taking the buddy cop formula and we are just overlaying instead of a fictional cartoon universe on it. We're overlaying a fictional fantasy universe over it. I think Roger Rabbit is probably the better of the two films, for sure. But it is kind of fun to see what they've done with this and how good it's at, like how much Roger Rabbit still holds up.
Yeah, I think one more I would throw in is the James Woods, Michael J. Fox movie, The Hard Way.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and also, I mean, L.A. Confidential.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we gotta throw that in there.
The Two Jakes, which was the sequel to Chinatown. I actually haven't seen that, and I know it is not nearly as well-beloved as the original, but it's another one that deals heavily with corruption and city infrastructure. And also, dude, I'm a defender. I'm not going to like go to the ropes on this. It's not really a hill I'm going to die on. I actually thought season two of True Detective wasn't that bad. And I think because season two of True Detective dealt more with infrastructure, land swindles, and political corruption kind of on this level than it did with esoteric Ambrose Bierce, Dagon, H.P. Lovecraft kind of occult stuff, I think that's why people were kind of cold on it. But if you were to hit, I think, True Detective now with your expectations fairly tempered and knowing that you're going in expecting this corruption tale, it's still a pretty good season of television.
Sometimes your worst self is your best self.
My strong suspicion is we get the world we deserve.
This isn't me doing this. This isn't me.
This girl's gone missing. Nobody cares. The interior's poisoned, and suddenly worth billions. Nobody cares.
Honestly, even the finale of season one, I think people wrongly burdened with incorrect expectations.
Yeah, I agree.
Because, like,
they wanted it to be a Cthulhu monster at the end, and it wasn't. It's more grounded
and
than that.
They think that would have been cool, but it really would have been stupid.
Yeah.
Like, it would not have worked as good as they think.
No. So, Matt, have you seen season three at all?
I have not delved into that yet. What I hear is that it's like most people's preference is shaking out 1, 3, 2.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, I am so behind on television. I still need to catch up with the Deadwood movie. I need to... I have a lot of stuff I need to watch.
We can finally watch Walking Dead.
I hear it's over. I don't know. Wait, no, the comic book is over. The TV series is still
going. I think the TV show is, too.
Is it?
Or,
I don't know.
Or will be soon. Or instead of watching Walking Dead, you can just play The Last of Us again. Have you played The Last of Us?
I have not.
You get to control a 13-year-old innocent little girl when she shanks like 19 guys. Like, I mean, she makes it rain, dude. She kills people. You fight a tribe of cannibals. And you pick them off in the shadows one by one and cut their jugulars. It's shockingly violent. And then your other co-character you play at one point, he gets in a fist fight with a guy. And the guy says, "You hit really hard, man." He goes, "Yeah, I was trying to kill you." it's like really weirdly one of the better post-apocalyptic things that exists.
Hmm.
And it has cool fungus zombies in it.
So they've danced around this. They've talked about this. They've discussed this. Nothing's ever come up. We play a game on the podcast every now and then called Should It Be Remade? Now, I don't think that a remake of the property is on the table, but what about a sequel, prequel, something else in this universe? Would you be game for that?
I'd like to know more about the ecology of Toons.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe something else set in the world. Like, we don't know what happens after the Toons receive their sort of freedom in the end.
Yeah, what happens when the 10 actually doesn't get built and there are no freeways in Los Angeles? Like, what does that look like?
I'm assuming it just goes around it and it's slightly slower. Yeah.
You know, I think one of the ideas that they originally pitched was a prequel where it was kind of the Toons go to war. And it was Roger and a cadre of, like, Dirty Dozen Toons decide they're going to break Jessica out of a Nazi prison. I believe that idea was shot down by Spielberg. But
they took that completely seriously.
Exactly.
And, like, the Third Reich had kidnapped Jessica because they want to know what makes Toons tick to make floppy, unkillable, hilarious super soldiers.
Right? See, yeah. I like it.
We keep making Ubermenches, but they keep being ridiculous. Like, you have, like, it would be almost like that Overlord movie with just, like, the horrible lab of half-Toon, half-Nazi. Just really lean into it. And then, of course, then, like I was saying before, like, potentially, like, Toons could be rather horrific, you know? And just this notion of, like, Roger Rabbit in a battle frenzy.
Well, and you think about it, if Bugs Bunny and Wile E. Coyote are present in Toontown in the 40s, why not Spawn in the mid-90s? Like, what, or, you know, or, like, what happens when Robert Crumb's Toons jump off the page and start strolling around? Like, what was the 60s like for Toontown?
Yeah, or the heavy metal era.
Ooh, yeah, ooh.
Of course I know what to do. It's my luck.
All right, Matt. Well, any final thoughts vis-a-vis Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Yeah, I do have a final thought. That sequel is a terrible idea. There should definitely not be horrible Nazi tunes. Or maybe should there be? I'm on the fence here.
Bob Zemeckis keeps threatening to do a sequel or another idea in this line. But Robert Zemeckis is very in love with digital technology lately.
Oh.
You know, he did the Polar Express. He's done a lot of mocap stuff.
I didn't mind the mocapped Beowulf.
Yeah, I didn't mind it either. I think it wasn't amazing. I was kind of wanting more out of a Neil Gaiman written Beowulf. But yeah, it was all right.
Well, he didn't write like a mocapped Beowulf.
No, he just wrote the script.
Walks into the long hall. And he says, "Tonight I shall prepare for mocapped Grendel."
Crispin Glover, I might add, who was also in Back to the Future.
I thought, actually, I liked that that particular Beowulf because that has it incorporated a little bit of like John Gardner's Grendel, the subplot with them being effectively disruptive.
Uh-huh.
And it gets the kind of root of what that story is, which is like a taming of the wild,
right,
you know, which is what a lot of those myths of that era were. Can you believe our ancestors killed sticks with bears?
Yeah, I'm sorry?
Can you believe our ancestors killed bears with sticks? We just sent Grubhub back because we didn't have any sour cream.
First you stick a rag, put it in the bag, bump, bump. Then you bend your back, put it in the sack, bump, bump. That's the way it's done. It's a lot of fun, bump, bump. Cutting capers, putting papers in the bag.
All right, Matt. Well, for the listeners at home, find us on Facebook, find us on Stitcher, find us on Spotify, find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, find us at your podcatcher of choice. And as always, check out the other shows on the network, the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network, celebrating 1 year of partnership with the Nighthawks Podcast. Really great to be on board with those folks. In the meantime, I think, Matt, do you want to send us out?
Yeah, we're going to get out of here. We're going to go warm up some pecan pie, pour out some coffee, and we're going to snack on it because it's almost morning.
All right.
It is morning. That was my ASMR send-off.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh, Roger is my name, and after is my game. Come on, cowpoke, it's just a joke. Don't sit there on your brain. Woo-hoo-hoo! Nice shirt. Who's your tailor? Quasimodo?
All right, Matt. So, they've danced. Ooh.
Yeah.
This is raggy.
Hello, I'm the Podcast Without Fear Luke.
I'm the Uncanny Ryan.
I am Kylie the Poodinger.
I am the Superior Caitlin.
And I am the Agitated Kyle.
And we are most of the Nerd Dome Podcast.
Every Friday, some variation of this group gets together and talks about all things nerd.
The newest stuff in TV, movies, comics, video games, and more.
So join us in the Dome every Friday to hear all things nerd.
From a bunch of people who are probably a bit too into it.
Part of the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network.